Okay, perfect. So I guess I should introduce myself first of all. My name is Juan Osorio. I'm a PhD student at the Computational Physics Group here at ETH Zurich. I've been working these past few years in the group of Matthias Troyer. So he's my formal supervisor, but I've been also working in very close collaboration with Philip Corbo, who is at the University of Amsterdam now. And today I hope to give you a bit of a feeling and about the topics that I've been working on and that I've been interested in during these years. And maybe at the end, or well, at the end, I will try to touch upon a few things that I believe constitute interesting future routes for work in the realm of tensor networks. So just to get started, the tensor networks are usually referred to as an entanglement-based approach. And just to warm up a little bit slowly, I would like to quote here in a very graphical way a beautiful result by Matthew Hastings from 2007, which I think is something of a driving force behind the efforts in the field. So these results tell us that if we consider a Hamiltonian or a system which contains only local terms in the Hamiltonians, which can be bounded somehow, and then I add the ingredient that I throw in a gap to this system, then what he managed to show is that the ground state for this Hamiltonian will be a so-called area law for entanglement entropy, meaning that if I'm in 1D, as I sort of look at the entanglement entropy upon tracing out a subsystem, a part of this system, then it will grow at the beginning and then it will saturate to some constant, which is essentially an area law in 1D, which is of course a beautiful result from a theoretical perspective, but he also managed to make a contact with perhaps what is one of the most successful algorithms in one dimension, and that is the density matrix renormalization group, in that he also, he managed to show that such a ground state will admit an efficient representation in the form of matrix product state. So at the time this came out, the DMRG was already known from experience to behave incredibly well for 1D systems, and it was also known to be operating over the manifold of matrix product states, but it was only until his result that it really sort of gained a firm footing, and this, I think, gave a huge boost to the field. So in the end, in a way, what his result is giving us, and this whole quantum information approach is giving, is a hint as to how to attack the many-body problem in this huge exponentially growing Hilbert space, simply by targeting this tiny dot in that huge space of low entanglement states, so states obeying an area law for entanglement entropy. So I mentioned matrix product states. I believe most of you will be familiar with these states, but just let me quickly go through some of their properties. So what I'm showing you here is the typical representation of a matrix product state in terms of rank 3 tensors. So those balls are tensors and those sticks are indices. And so the amplitude of a given basis state on a given quantum state, once they fix the spins, will simply be given by the product of matrices, thus the name of the ansatz. As I already mentioned, this ansatz obeys an area law for entanglement entropy, but it also possesses other very interesting properties from the more practical side. So on one hand, it provides, in some sense, an efficient encoding in that it only requires a number of variational parameters that grows linearly with the system size. And also importantly, it can be seen as an efficient algorithm, or the DMRG can be seen as a computationally efficient algorithm in that the number of operations that you need to perform, say, to optimize the wave function or to perform a measurement, scales as the third power of the bond dimension, and the memory will scale more or less as the second power or d squared of the bond dimension for this MPS. And so given the results of Hastings, sort of this motivated people to generalize this ansatz in the hopes that results of comparable quality would be achievable for higher dimensional systems. And so essentially what are called projected entangled per states are nothing but a direct, straightforward generalization of matrix product states to higher dimensions, in which one sort of performs a covering of that physical lattice with tensors. The reason they're called projected entangled per states is simply because one can imagine them as arising from the introduction of some auxiliary degrees of freedom, which are perfectly entangled on the bonds of that graph or on the bonds of the lattice, and then the PEPS tensors can be seen as projectors down from this auxiliary space to the physical level. And since they are perfectly entangled, this becomes a contraction over the tensors that make up the PEPS ansatz. The state also, by construction, obeys an area law for entanglement entropy. And in the same sense that I mentioned before, provides an efficient encoding in that one only has to deal with a linear number of, or a number of variational parameters that varies linearly with the number of sites on the system. Now, of course, one can also ask the question whether this is a truly efficient algorithm in the sense of evaluating observables and optimizing the tensors for a ground state search. And it actually turns out to be the case that this is not true. So the cost of an operation, like a measurement of a local observable, will actually scale exponentially with a linear system size, linear system size, essentially. So this, in a way, puts a hard wall on what one can achieve from an exact computation with PEPS. So this doesn't hold. In what remains, I will be really interested in the infinite version of this ansatz, so the infinite projected entangled per states, and I will hope to give you an idea of how one works with these algorithms or these states in practice rather quickly. So the starting point is some unit cell, like for example here, this 2x4 unit cell that repeats itself indefinitely in all directions. And then, of course, since one cannot really work with an infinite system in practice, one is forced to introduce some effective description of that infinite system surrounding the unit cell. So what one does in practice is one takes these little chunks of sort of infinite chunks represented by those yellow squares, and one introduces what are called environment tensors to sort of encode the information that corresponds to that part of the system. Of course, the properties that I mentioned before are still there. And this means that we have to introduce an approximate way of performing computations like evaluation of observables. This is what is called a contraction scheme, just a way of reducing that tensor network to a scalar, the object that we want to compute. And just very briefly, let me show you how one of these contraction schemes work. This is the one that we prefer to use. The Phil Corbo has also been using over the years, and the one that I have most experience with, but it's definitely not the only one out there. And so to create that infinite environment, what one does is one starts, for example, in this case, from a one-site unit cell that I have shown you here with a red A tensor, and then introduces those C1 or C and T tensors on the boundaries, which will eventually end up encoding the infinite system. And so to grow that infinite environment, what one does is one first performs, say, a directional insertion towards the left, of that T4A and T2 column into the C1, T1, and C2 column, and then absorbs those tensors. In performing this computation, one will essentially increase the number of states that are sort of playing a role on the boundary that I am symbolizing by a thick purple line. And so one has to renormalize somehow. One has to reduce the number of states that one is keeping in that boundary in some way. This, I will not tell you in detail how it happens, but it's essentially typically done via the insertion of approximate resolutions of identity. Right, so this is, as I mentioned, this is, for example, how that contraction scheme would look in the single layer picture. So for example, if I wanted to evaluate the partition function for a 2D classical system, this is very typical of what would arise. In the 2D, in the quantum case, what I would have is the so-called double layer picture. So I really need to think of these tensors that I'm showing you now as being sort of the two layers of the bra and the ket merged together. In that setting, the computational cost of this contraction scheme goes roughly as chi cubed d to the 6, where this chi cubed is the parameter that I was mentioning before that controls the number of states that one keeps for the boundary representation. So in practice, one finds that the sky scales more or less as the square of the Pabst spun dimension. And then morally, this is an something like a d to the 12 computational cost, which is significantly higher than what one sees for the MPS algorithms, and explains why we cannot go anywhere near the values of the bond dimension that the emerging practitioners can achieve. Right. So how do we get those tensors to encode the ground state information? One typically does, or traditionally does, the so-called imaginary time evolution. We start off from some random state and start hitting that random state with the exponential of the Hamiltonian until eventually it converges to the ground state, well, provided that it was not orthogonal to the ground state itself. In this very simple picture, it looks sort of very straightforward. One has to introduce additional types of dealing with the high complexity, ways of dealing with the high complexity of these operations. And so over the time, people have been working mostly with two types of updates. The so-called simple update is one which only takes into account the local objects touched by a two-body gate in this imaginary time evolution operation. And it's essentially only exact or asymptotically exact in Bethe-like lattices. So if one goes to lattices which have loops, it's not a perfectly controlled approximation. And indeed, if I go to say a regime close to a second order phase transition, one can really see that the results deteriorate by using this type of update. To improve on that, people will also use the so-called full update, which fully accounts for the environment of that set of tensors that's being updated by the two-body gate, and this is significantly more expensive. So it's not used as often, and it's avoided if possible. And more recently, there have been this year there were a couple of proposals for the actual variation optimization, something more akin to what is done for DMRG. And I think this is really something that will help really get nice improved results overall. Right, so this sort of concludes my introduction of PEPS. I know it was very fast, and if you have questions, please let me know. If not, then I'll just move on to a few applications that I would like to show you today. So the first one is an application we had of the IPEPS algorithm to the so-called Kitaev-Heisenberg model. And before I move to the full Kitaev-Heisenberg model, which was proposed for the, which has been discussed in the context of the layered iridates, I would like to touch on the original Kitaev-Honeycomb model. So this is a model which is defined in the honeycomb lattice, and what you do is you have to essentially label the bonds on that honeycomb model, on that honeycomb lattice by X, Y, and Zs. And then on each of these bonds, you will insert a Ising type interaction coupling only the spin components matching the type of that bond. So this is a model which was introduced by Kitaev in 2006. As I mentioned, it contains Ising time couplings, but it's a strongly frustrated model. And it's very simple to see that if I satisfy one of these energy constraints, then I will not be able to satisfy the other energy constraints. It actually turns out to be an exactly soluble model. And Kitaev showed that the ground state contains a C2 spin liquid phase, essentially. So the phase diagram in a nutshell, the phase diagram of this model looks as follows. So I'm showing you a triangle that arises if you sort of generate a three-dimensional space out of the JX, the JY, and the JC couplings in each Euclidean direction, let's say, and then you intersect a plane orthogonal to the 1-1-1 direction, touching the unit values on each axis, you get this triangle. And essentially, in a nutshell, it has two phases. One is the A phase, which in certain limits can be mapped to the toric code, which is, I'm sure, a model which will ring a bell for people who are interested in topological order, and which, by the way, can be the ground state of which can be encoded very efficiently as a PEPS wave function. And it also has a gapless phase, the so-called B phase, which, as shown by Kitaev, hosts non-abelian harmonic excitations. So this also makes it very interesting from the perspective of the experiments, because this is definitely something that will be very exciting from find a material that sort of shows these physics. Now, as I mentioned, the A phase in a certain limit can be written down potentially as a toric code, as a PEPS exactly. And as long as I'm gapped, then I expect IPEPS to behave quite well. But then the question is, what happens inside the gapless region? This should be more challenging. And so it wasn't clear at the beginning whether it would be possible to fully encode the physics in that regime with IPEPS. Moreover, there had actually been a publication which was claiming that this was not possible, that IPEPS could not encode the physics of the B phase. The first thing we did was really try to address this point. Can we really get a good description of that phase? So I will be concentrating now on the point in which all the key type couplings are the same, JX, UY, and JZ are the same. And from the exact solution by Kitaev, I know that the energy is 0.3936, which is given by that yellow line there on the upper part of the plot. So this line here. And then what I'm showing you is data that start from d equals to 4 here and go all the way to d equals to 7 here. So what we see is really both for the ferromagnetic as well as for the anti-ferromagnetically coupled Kitaev model, we see a monotonic decrease in energy very nicely heading towards the exact value. In the end, it seems that we can get something on the order of 3.5 digits accuracy for the values of D that we managed to reach in this study. Another feature of this model is that since it's a spin liquid phase, it should really not break, it should not show spin ordering, essentially magnetic ordering. So the magnetization here that I'm showing you with an M here is really an order parameter that we essentially use to measure whether there is any form of symmetry breaking. And there as well, we find that, the magnetization is really strongly suppressed. It systematically goes down to zero. And for the largest values of these that we have, which are here, we have something of the order of 0.01 or 0.02, which is a very strongly suppressed value. So it's really telling us that it seemed to be in the right phase. So the last criterion that we used for this model to really make sure that we're in the right phase is to use an additional rather peculiar property of this model, which are the nearest neighbor correlations or the correlations in general, which as was shown by Baskaran and co-workers in 2007, are of ultra short range type, meaning that there's essentially everything is zero unless you're evaluating the, say, sigma x correlator on the x bond or the yy in the y bond, et cetera, et cetera. And the precise value is the one I'm giving you here, 0.525. The upper graph shows you the measurement of exactly those correlators which should not be zero. And in the antiferromagnetically coupled phase, and the lower one in the ferromagnetically coupled one. And there we then see also a very nice monotonic behavior going to the exact value. It should be said that you can probably see already that there is an asymmetry in the ZZ correlator as compared to the XX and the YY correlators. And this is essentially an artifact of how we embed the honeycomb lattice as a brick wall lattice in our environments in such a way that we can contract it. So in doing that mapping, we necessarily treat the ZZ bonds, the Z bonds in an asymmetric way compared to the X and Y bonds. And then this gives rise to this asymmetry, but it's nevertheless sort of nice to see that as one goes to larger and larger bond dimension, this asymmetry in the treatment of those bonds sort of starts disappearing in a way. Right, so this essentially, I hope by now I've managed to convince you that we're really in the right phase and that our PEPS wave functions are really capturing or are really true putative spin liquid phases here. So with that being said, now I would like to move on to the full Kitaev Heisenberg model. It's sort of defined made up of two terms, the usual Heisenberg SU2 symmetric spin interaction and the Kitaev spin interaction here on the right. This is a model which was proposed by Chalukyan and co-workers in the context of the layered aridate compounds of these forms, a sodium or lithium 2, iridium 3. And from their initial study, their initial proposal from this paper in 2013, it seemed it was shown that the model contained, as a natural ground state phase, the type of order that had been measured for the materials. So this made it sort of an interesting proposal. And then we wanted to address this because this extended model had only been treated by Chalupa and co-workers on a 24-site cluster using exact diagonalization. Just a bit of the previous results. There was, before this model was proposed, there was a restricted version proposed, which was constrained to this quadrant here on the lower left side. And there remain some questions regarding the survival of that Kitaev's liquid phase as one went to the thermodynamic limit. So there have been claims saying that this phase does not survive the thermodynamic limit. So this is not really a phase, it's just a point in the phase diagram. And then when straight up goes into a magnetically ordered stripy phase, as one shifts away from the pure Kitaev point and starts introducing anti-ferromagnetic Heisenberg interactions. It wasn't clear. Some other studies from DMRG were saying that this was a perfectly finite region. But again, those were small system studies going up to 48, or I can't remember exactly the number right now. So it was still a small system study making that claim. So we wanted to address that directly at the thermodynamic limit. Of course, we also were interested in the precise locations of those phase transitions, were they to exist, and the type of phase transitions that they would be in case there are any. Right, so our approach essentially in this model went as follows. What we did was we first did an overall mapping of the phase diagram to get a rough idea for the types of phases that would be arising and where they would be located. We ended up finding the same phases that the original study found. So an AL phase in this part of the phase diagram where one has antiferromagnetic Heisenberg couplings. Then a zigzag phase where sort of zigzag chains alternate between, so zigzag chains of aligned spins alternate with chains which are aligned in the opposite direction. And then also the usual ferromagnetically ordered phase and this stripy ordered phase that I mentioned before. So once one has the raw phase diagram for that model, what one can try to do is address the question of the type of phase transition. So if one has a first order phase transition, if I try to push a ground state which has been optimized deep in some phase, and I try to optimize it in some parameter regime where one should already be slightly across the phase transition, then one expects to see some sort of mid stability, and we might be able to see an energy crossing there. So this was the idea. If we take representative ground states in the middle of those phases, and then we drag them and optimize it as we cross the phase transition and there remains energy crossing, then we have good evidence for a first order phase transition. On the other hand, if those energies just match very nicely and the states more or less go one into the other, then this is probably, together with some order parameter information, this will most likely be a second order phase transition. So that's exactly what we did. I'm showing you here this energy crossing analysis. So the x-axis of is the degree, the part on the phase diagram where I'm sitting, the vertical, the y-axis of the energy per site, and the green curve represents the stripy ordered phase for a D equals to C 6 PEPS calculation. The blue line is the spin liquid, the tensors which are in the spin liquid phase. And what we can see is that indeed by taking those tensors across the phase transition, there is a regime in which they remain stable. So they're still there and they do not go into the competing phase. So so these energies are crossing at a finite angle. So this is telling us that this transition appears to be first order. And of course, as I mentioned before, that this spin liquid does have a finite survival region, essentially. The vertical lines that I'm showing you here, this leftmost one is for PEPS D equals to 4, the red one is at D equals to 5, and the yellow one is at D equals to 6, which is the one that I'm showing you right now. So what we're seeing here is that as one increases the bond dimension in these states, meaning as one allows more and more quantum fluctuations to enter these states, the spin liquid phase appears to be gaining ground against the stripy ordered phase. And ultimately, at least for this value, what we find is a phase transition around minus 80 degrees. Right. Now, I can also look at order parameters. So as I already mentioned, there was the magnetization order parameter that sort of measures any form of symmetry breaking. Here, green is, again, stripy ordered states. Blue is spin liquid states. And one can clearly see a strong discontinuity as one crosses that phase transition. So to make sure that this is pure stripe order, I'm showing you here on the inset some order parameter designed to capture that stripy order, and one can really see that it's pure stripy order contained in those states. In addition to that, it should be mentioned that as one increases the bond dimension for this data, the discontinuity does appear to be somewhat suppressed. Although from what we can see, I'm not going to show you the data, but from what we can see, it seems like there will definitely be a finite discontinuity there as one crosses that phase transition. We can also look at other types of order. So here on the left, I'm showing you the variation in energies per bond. So as one crosses as one comes from the spin liquid phase, in which there's essentially no difference between the bond energies for the different types of bonds, and then one crosses the phase transition, then there is a jump. There is a type of bond that acquires a lower energy compared to the others. And also the dominant nearest neighbor correlations exhibit somewhat of a discontinuity. Here, these dominant correlations inside the spin liquid phase appear to be somewhat stiff. So they change a bit, but it's not quite visible on this scale. And this somehow matches some previous results from a slave particle mean field approach on the original formula, on the restricted formulation of the Kitaev-Heisenberg model. So I can play this game across the full phase diagram, and what I will end up seeing, or what we ended up seeing in the end, was the following. So we have this full circle of that constitutes the phase diagram, and what we see is that there is indeed, both for the anti-ferromagnetically coupled as well as for the ferromagnetically coupled, there is a finite extent of those spin liquid phases. So that for us, it's very strong evidence showing that this spin liquid does survive in the thermodynamic limit, as well. And on top of that, we see that essentially all the phase transitions here, as well as here in the anti-ferromagnetically coupled regime, appear to be first order. Although it should be also said that here on the upper case, where the Kitaev couplings are anti-ferromagnetic, these discontinuities are much, much weaker. So I think this is really a reflection of the nature of the competing phases. The fact that they have that Nail phase, which is more quantum than that ferromagnetic phase on the south side of that phase diagram, really means that also that phase can profit from more quantum fluctuations, and thus the order parameter gets suppressed. So, right. So in the end here, we find, I'm showing you here a comparison of the transition points that we found compared to the initial Lancho study on the 24-site cluster. And what we find are very marginal corrections to what they found on this upper part of the phase diagram. The largest corrections are here, where there's a variation of a few degrees, 4 or 6 degrees, in going from the ferromagnetically coupled spin liquid phase to the stripy phase, and the same from the ferromagnetically coupled spin liquid phase to the ferromagnetic phase. So our data is definitely supporting finite spin liquid regions with discontinuous phase transitions towards the magnetically ordered phases. Right, now I would like to move on to a second application that is more recent. That is the, we wanted to perform a little competition between infinite matrix product states and infinite projective entangled pair states on infinite cylinders. So if you're familiar, I'm sure you're familiar with the recent literature. And so, as I already mentioned, the DMRG is really the golden standard for 1D systems. And I don't think anybody would dare sort of question this. It's really the guy to beat in 1D. And it's also incredible that this is the case also for 2D. So to give you a couple of examples, I'm showing you here the Kaigonga lattice Heisenberg model. And these are ground state energies. And if you see these red, this blue, and these dashed blue lines, those are DMRG results. And they're sitting right there, very close to the bottom of, or essentially they're in within the most competitive energies for this model. Also for the, one can also look at the Fermi-Hubbard model on the square lattice. This is from a paper from the Simons collaboration. I'm looking at the Hubbard model at half filling with a parameter of U over T equals to 8. So this is not a particularly controversial regime for the Hubbard model. And comparing the energies from this auxiliary field quantum Monte Carlo, which to my understanding are essentially exact in this regime, and seeing where the DMRG data is sitting compared to that data, is really incredible. It's really showing that this algorithm, which was designed for 1D systems, is potentially obtaining the best quality energy of this plot among all other methods. So that's pretty impressive. And these systems are usually approached using cylinders, so we can preserve these translational invariants in one direction. So the question is, can we improve on this? Can we do better with PEPs on infinite cylinders? And the answer is that in principle, we should. And the reason, I can give you a very simple entropic argument for that. So if I want to do a finite size calculation with an MVS on a system of size 6 by 5 here, I will typically snake through that system like here. And then, as you already know, the maximum entropy that this MPS can encode is upper bounded by the logarithm of the bond dimension. So it means that if I want to get, I'm targeting a ground state which has an area law, then morally the D will have to grow exponentially fast with the width of that system so that I can account for the right, for the entanglement of that phase, of that state. On the other hand, if I do the same thing with a PEPS, then of course by construction I obey an area law, so the D doesn't have to scale anything. It's already area law, so for something that's essentially constant, I should be able to provide the right amount of entanglement. And I guess what I'm trying to say here is that essentially the MPS are no longer expected to be efficient in 2D. So when we ask the question, you know, very naively, very hand wavy, in a very hand wavy fashion, where is the crossover between both algorithms? We don't expect to beat MPS for systems which are very thin, because it really performs incredibly well there. But one can play a little game of performing a calculation of what would be the equivalent bond dimension in going from a, say, D equals 4 PEPS on a width equals 8 cylinder, and try to infer the required bond dimension from the MPS side in order to get the same entropic contribution. One ends up with something which is on the order of 65,000, which is, given the current state of the art of the algorithm, essentially beyond what is currently reachable. What is currently reachable for the DMRG is something on the order of 20 to 30,000, and this is really pushing it. These are really simulations which are being parallelized and running on hundreds of nodes on large machines, which is something that, at least from the two-dimensional algorithm side, from the PEP side, we're still not doing. So we should be able to do better than them. Right. So here's some data on how the IMPS energy or accuracy behaves on cylinders for the square lattice Heisenberg model. I'm using a loop quantum Monte Carlo data as a reference here. So I can essentially get something like 10 to the minus 5 accuracy reliably. And what one sees is really that for the thin cylinder, so a width equals to 4 cylinder here on the bottom, the decay or the approach of that exact energy is extremely fast, so I can get something like 5 digits with a bond dimension of 100. And also, since it's bending down, this is really an exponential convergence towards the exact value. And so as I move to thicker and thicker cylinders, what I see is, of course, the effort goes up, the lines are shifting up, but also importantly, they start to look a bit more like straight lines. So this is a consequence of the fact that for this model, even though we always have a gap, the gap starts close as I go to wider and wider cylinders. And so the effort starts becoming even larger and larger for IMPS in order to approximate the ground state. Right, so that's sort of what one sees and what one expects from IMPS in the cylinders. What happens with IPEPS? How do we proceed from here on? There's not really much out there saying on how one should proceed, because perhaps in a justified way, people are not very keen on attacking this problem because of the periodic boundary conditions. So we had to really try to figure out what the best way or what a good way is of really putting the PEPS on the cylinder and contracting it in a reasonable way. So how can I reduce this sort of infinite cylinder PEPS into something that I can work with essentially for computations? I'm going to show you only two approaches here. This is the naive or the natural way to proceed if you're inspired by open boundary condition PEPS calculations. So you will try to approximate that infinite cylinder by an open boundary condition matrix product state, and this you do essentially by thinking of these boundaries as quantum states and of these PEPS transfer columns columns as an MPO, and you just simply minimize the distance between the original MPS and the final MPS and the guy with the PEPS MPO applied to it. Right. The observable evaluation can proceed in a very analogous way from the top to bottom once I have already continued, once I have obtained a converged boundary, essentially. The second approach, this is a summary. The procedure number one, this open boundary condition matrix product state, has a few advantages. It means it profits from the stability of the MPS optimization procedure, and one can deal with observables which contain contributions from operators which are not necessarily very close to one another very easily. But it has this advantage that it will break translational symmetry in the vertical direction. The computational scaling of this algorithm, of this version of the contraction, will go as chi cubed d6, which is the same one I mentioned before. But one has to be careful, because in having this periodic bond here, that chi will actually morally not scale as d squared, but it will potentially scale as d to the 4. So what one has here is really something that could end up scaling or morally scales as a d to the 18. So this is a really big jump in computational complexity as compared to the fully infinite case. Then one can also try to cook up another approach, which is somewhat inspired by what we do in the infinite systems, and try to preserve that translational symmetry that might be present in the original PEPS wave function. And this one does by inserting resolutions of identity as one coarse grains these rows of tensors to obtain an approximate periodic boundary condition matrix product state as my effective infinite cylinder description. So this is just some details on the computation. I will not mention anything else there. Right. So the advantages here is, as I already mentioned, when preserves translational symmetry and potentially allows us to recycle objects from the infinite size simulation. In practice, what we see is that this really accelerates the convergence of the algorithm if we recycle these objects. And it has the disadvantage that, at least in the most straightforward way of implementing it, one can only deal with operators which are very close to one another. It also has the potential bias of if you include this acceleration, then you're sort of including a bias into what you will converge to at the end. The computational scaling here is a bit milder, at least from this perspective, it scales as chi cubed d to the 8. And here, since we're not trying to represent the periodic boundary condition transfer matrix with an open boundary condition, we don't have to scale the chi as d to the 4, but here it can scale as it did before, so d squared. And you end up with something which is morally ordered d to the 14 computational scale, which is also still pretty high. Right.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes.
So I'm confused about this scheme. Do you actually see the finite size of the system? Is there any step where the finite size plays a role?
In the evaluation of the observables. So what I'm trying to present to you today is really trying to make the best out of recycling the PEPS tensors from the infinite calculation, and then one embeds those into the cylinder and then performs the computation on the cylinder of the computation of measuring. So at this point, I'm not going to show you any data on tensors that have been optimized specifically for the cylinder.
Okay, so you are trying to extract information at this point? You optimize the tensors in the infinite system?
Yes.
Possibly? Well, you have optimized tensors in some way.
Exactly.
And now you want to evaluate those on a cylinder?
Yes.
Okay, but even there, the MPS, boundary MPS itself, the way it's being updated, doesn't know about the finite size of the system.
You can let it know in a way. You can try to do some sort of regauging analogous to the implementation of these unitary constraints in the usual MPS optimization. So I can try to put some QR transformations from locations far away or in the opposite on the opposite side of where I will introduce the isometries, the resolutions of identity. And in that sense, one introduces some finite size information, I would say.
Right, but the way you've discussed it, that was not done, right? The sketch that you presented. I'm just saying, if we were to introduce periodic boundary conditions, if we take seriously the periodic boundary conditions on the MPS, mm-hmm. then I don't see how this is going to be chi to the 3.
Right. Okay, I see. So, right, sure. Is that okay?
But you're saying that you still will account for periodic boundary conditions once you've converged the MPS by looking at the final calculation once. So you converge the MPS, and then you will have a finite contraction of indices, which
exactly.
will be on a finite
exactly.
geometry.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. So you will see some effects of the finite geometry,
mm-hmm.
even
yes,
though
definitely.
Even the boundary MPS could have been optimized in the infinite plane.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
The
way you're converging the MPS, unless you add the extra elements that you just mentioned,
mm-hmm.
would be the same as if you were optimizing the boundary MPS on the plane.
Almost, yeah. I mean, it's almost the same because, yeah, I mean, okay, it depends on how you do the calculation, but yeah, I guess you're right. That's true, yes.
Okay, all
right. Good, yeah. right, so I was told I should not take too long. That would be very, very bad. I'm already at 42 minutes. So I will show you some convergence properties of these schemes. Here is the energy per site as a function of that chi that for the boundary MPS. And what we see for a width, this is a width 6 cylinder, is that indeed the open boundary approach tends to converge somewhat slower. The periodic boundary approach converges much faster. And in this, I have several data here because I also wanted to show you we have to introduce an additional singular value decomposition once we have converged the boundary MPS. What we decompose essentially everything that is not involved in the measurement via some SVD to reduce the cost, and one also has to monitor convergence as a function of that SVD, as the number of states that one keeps in that SVD. So here, For a d equals to 3 PEPS tensors and width 6, one can see that convergence as a function of the boundary chi is happening rather nicely and rather quickly. But the convergence with this vertical chi is not as fast though. And also, it should be said very specifically, very explicitly, that this bottom data here corresponds to PEPS tensors which have been optimized on the plane using the variational procedure. Here I have simple update tensors which are completely oblivious to any form of system size. I do the same. I can show you the same thing for a width 12 cylinder now, and it becomes clear that that vertical chi that I'm calling chi BTM here in the legend essentially plays no role. It converges extremely quickly. This is a consequence of the fact that for this model we're using a checkerboard structure, and so what remains inside a measurement is essentially like a product of little unit cells, and this converges exponentially fast. Right, and then again, convergence of the open boundary condition MPS is much lower compared to the periodic version of the algorithm. Something that we also don't like too much here is that if you don't have large enough chi's, the open boundary condition MPS approach seems to approach the actual converged value from below, which is also not too nice. Right, so now let's see how they compare to one another. This is real IMPS versus IPEPS for the square lattice Heisenberg model on a cylinder of varying width. So the red data are IPEPS tensors for the simple update or the variational update, depending on the tag. The green curves are infinite matrix product state computations starting from 350 states down to 2050 states. And the blue line are loop quantum Monte Carlo data, which is our reference. So it's clear here that the simple update really offers really poor performance, but really even if we have obtained these PEPS tensors on the plane, the variational update seems to provide really nice results, or quite nice results. In the end, what we end up finding is a crossing of these finite D data around 8 or 10. So you might say, yeah, you can go to larger D, so on and so forth. It's true. If I showed you the D equals 4,000 data for the IMPS, this crossing would still be in the same location. Right. So, okay, this is nice. It's we can see that we can get reasonable results here just by recycling the objects from the co-optimization on the plane. But one can also look at how that data is converging as a function of variational parameters, which I would feel is a nice way of putting both data together on the same plot. And okay, so here the red data is the red data is IPEPS calculations with the variational updated tensors on the plane. The green data are simple update calculations, and the purple data are IMPS calculations. And we can see that essentially starting from width 8, according to this plot, the convergence rate of those energies from PEPS is not affected at all. And in fact, it's already on the order of 10 to the minus 4, essentially. What we can do without any symmetries currently is around d equals to 7 for PEPS. And if I just were to naively try to see where that might go, if I use those tensors, it would be somewhere down here in this area, sort of already approaching what is feasible within the quantum Monte Carlo accuracy. And that's very, I would say, this is sort of encouraging, given that we haven't optimized these tensors specifically for the cylinder. But we haven't evaluated that. Right, now to conclude this part, I will just show you something on the Fermi-Hubbard model in the same regime that I was showing you before, half filling U over T equals to 8. And there, also what we see is a crossing even sooner. The width for the energy crossing for those algorithms is really appears to be around 6. So it's actually rather soon. And well, I think in the end, this sort of shows that it might actually prove to be a profitable approach. Maybe it is worth pursuing further, and this is what we're doing right now. So as you already mentioned, there is a clear crossover happening perhaps sooner than I'd expect. There is indeed room for improvement in the sense that we can still optimize those tensors in the for the cylinders. And this is sort of what we're trying to do right now, trying to evaluate if this will be a feasible approach from a practical perspective. I mean, it has to take into account the actual runtime of simulations and how hard it is to implement and so on. But this is something that we're still working on. Okay. So these were the two applications that I wanted to talk to you about today quickly. And then I should also sort of comment a bit on where do we go from here? Where could we go from here according to my personal tastes and what I'm interested in. And well, I guess I could say that the area of frustrated magnetism is definitely an area in which we can make a contribution. Of course, their sign problems are usually or often precluding the application of quantum Monte Carlo algorithms. And as we have seen, we can get reasonable results with our algorithms for a model like the Kitaev-Heisenberg model, for example. And there, in the context of materials, there's been additional work trying to refine those models, trying to cook up a model that really does encode the true physics on those materials. I think this is something we can pursue a bit further. There's also been quite a bit of proposals for finite temperature calculations. I think here, a first step should involve really trying to gather those that appear to be more promising and then just testing them on a very sort of equal basis and trying to filter out from all this zoo of proposals what is actually useful and what is actually not useful on more challenging scenarios. I think, and this is perhaps a bit of a wider scope, is that the tensor network practitioners as a community should start thinking of developing some common ecosystem on which we can all contribute and develop algorithms that can be reused and used sort of for not only for research or production data, but also for testing different or testing improvements on what already exists. This would be sort of analogous to what the ALPS libraries have been doing for the past 20 years. And I think it would be really a good opportunity to get people involved in this in the tension networks community to develop highly tested, thoroughly tested codes. These are codes that it's very easy to make mistakes and end up with bugs in your codes. I think we should really try to develop a database of codes that are highly tested and people can use to work on that. Also, something that I believe we should start paying attention to is how do we go beyond the single core computation? How do I go beyond computations that could essentially run on my laptop? Because this is more or less what we've been doing, at least with PEPS the whole time. We of course can use large clusters to parallelize simulations over a parameter sweep, but the actual computation itself is essentially sequential. So we're not really profiting properly from from the computational power that these new machines are offering. And I think this is something that where we can also make some progress. Of course, there's a lot of other ideas like using tensor network normalization for RG flows and so on. But I've hit the 52-minute line, and I'm not sure you guys will be very happy if I continue for a long time. Is it okay if I continue? Should I stop here? I can just say a few words more about a few of these things. Otherwise, I'll just stop here and take your questions, essentially. I get 5 minutes.
Yeah, okay, let's get the last 5 more minutes. 5 more minutes, is that true?
Sure, yeah, that's fine. Okay, so I'll just say a few things about, just a few more words on these things. So in the frustrated magnetism, as I already mentioned, there's opportunities in models that can be improved. So the Hamiltonian that I showed you that we worked on before is essentially described by this phase diagram, and it naturally encodes the phase that is observed in materials, but actually this order appears to arise in the wrong side of the phase diagram, because what one expects for what is essentially observed from ab initio calculations and other considerations is that in the materials, the nearest neighbor Kitaev coupling should actually be ferromagnetic. And in that regime, this model gives the wrong type of stripy order. So people have been developing more models. I think this is also something that is that fits nicely into the whoa, what just happened.
We lost the screen. Oh,
yeah, so did I.
You lost his slides. Oh, you lost the
screen. Yeah, this, my computer is dying on me right now. My, man, what's this? No, okay, fine. Is that fine?
Yeah.
Good. Right, so there's been extensions to this model, the so-called JK Gamma model. This was proposed by Rao. This is, I think it's a postdoc now at UWaterloo, if I'm not mistaken. And he essentially, you know, proposed an extension where he adds these so-called off-diagonal terms to the Hamiltonian. Their considerations were restricted to a classical approach, and an ED approach was somehow restricts the accuracy of that can be obtained for these simulations. I think we could potentially contribute here. Additional extensions include this K1, K2 model, which introduces next nearest neighbor correlations, next nearest neighbor Kitaev couplings. In addition, in a proposal by this Russo Chatsakis guy from last year, and this is in their approach, they used also ED on small systems, 24 or 32, I believe, is the sizes that they used, and also some strong coupling approach, which somehow, I believe, leaves room for improvement, and I think we can also play an interesting role there. Right, so that's something. Then for finite temperature, what I find interesting is that actually PEPs have been shown to provide efficient representations of Gibbs states of local Hamiltonians, which is not the case for the ground state. So I think it's also motivating to a direction that could be potentially explored in the future. And of course, I think this would also, if one manages to get these algorithms running, I think this would really be interesting from the material side, because now if we can really get the simulations running, then we can really try to make perform simulations that can actually be compared to experimental data. And I think this is definitely very interesting. Here, of course, I don't know if people are familiar with the famous two-dimensional tensor network renormalization, the algorithm that gives rise to proper RG flows and some other handful of very nice properties. One can also ask the question, how do we generalize this to three dimensions? This is something that I've already mentioned before, and I think would be worth pursuing to some degree. Right. So that's 4 minutes, I think. And then I have one last section on addressing the complexity. So this is a real summary of how the scaling for different contraction schemes behaves. In the single layer picture, I'm just showing you three different contraction schemes. The CTM that I was telling you before is chi cubed d squared in the single layer picture, chi 6 or chi 7 for these other two guys. Again, one has to compare to the D3 of MPS methods. And of course, we're far away from the values of D that they can achieve. So at least on my side, I've been performing some experimentation on using GPUs to accelerate the computations. And at least it seems that for the leading tensor contraction, one can really get some improvement there, some reasonable speed up. So I'm really showing you here as a function of bond dimension, more or less the speed up factor that one expects in using a GPU compared to a single CPU. Once one performs the operation that contains the higher computational cost in those algorithms, and one can see that the speedup factor can be as high as, it goes from 2.5 to 50, essentially, depending on how one does the comparison. And here I think one can profit, and we indeed used it in the simulations for the Kitaev-Heisenberg model to speed up some of the computations. There's also so-called randomized range finders for the singular value decompositions. In the end, the bulk of the runtime for all simulations are given by either matrix multiplications or singular value decompositions. And I believe that one can also profit from these so-called randomized range finders. Unfortunately, I don't have the time to explain how they work, but they're just a way of performing truncated singular value decompositions by using random numbers. And one can see from these little experiments that one can achieve a reasonable, almost optimal quality in the approximation for various matrix sizes relevant to our simulations, while achieving a speedup which can be almost on the order of 10 or so. So I think this is also something nice that can be combined with the GPU approach. Definitely not the whole story. We have to think about more. We have to think way more about how to put this on larger machines. For example, the simple update, just the evolution is very simple to parallelize, but this cannot be the whole story. One also needs to go beyond the simple update because, well, the quality of those wave functions is usually not very good. And when one needs to think about how to parallelize those simulations, I can give you a few ideas on how to parallelize it as the unit cells get larger. But if I have a single unit cell, it's really not so obvious where the parallelization opportunities lie. And I think there's something that one can also consider in the future. So right, so now I've hit the 1 hour line, and I think it's time for me to stop here. Are you still there?
We are, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Right, so I guess I can change view now.
That's okay. So do you guys have any questions? No? Do you have questions?
I guess I maybe have one question. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's working. Okay. So just regarding the first order transition for the Kitaev-Heisenberg model that you were probing with PEPS. So you saw a jump in magnetization and in the energy, but so for me, having worked with MPS in the past, the bond dimensions are pretty small. It seems like you want to be pretty careful. Did you see convergence with the bond dimensions of these values?
No, that's what I mean. So the okay. So in our case, we have to converge not only with the PEPS of the D,
yeah,
but also with the chi. And so there was definitely convergence a function of chi, but what we were seeing is somehow analogous to what I was showing you also in the pure Kitaev case. So you can see the energy is going down, but it's not really like saturating or anything. It's really like you can see them going down a bit, and this is as far as we can go.
Yeah.
From the behavior as a function of increasing bond dimension, we believe that the discontinuity will remain, and we believe that the spin liquid phases will be finite. But this is as far as we can go. We can't really go any further than that.
Does your data allow, like, can you do an infinite bond dimension extrapolation or infinite chi extrapolation?
It's a very narrow range. I mean, we only have three values of the d, so d equals to 4, 5, and 6, because the spin liquid only showed starting at d equals to 4.
Okay.
So we have a very small set of values. So we essentially have to do a very naive extrapolation in 1 over d over three data points essentially, and that what we get from that is it should remain, but it's really not a very statistically significant extrapolation, I would say, if you just have two data points essentially.
Because one thing you mentioned, you had like a softening of this magnetization, I think. So what do you mean by that? Do you mean a shift, or do you mean if the transition really starts to soften?
The discontinuity really drops down a bit.
Oh, okay.
So if I go from d equals to 4, it starts sort of going down a tiny bit, but the rate at which that happens is low enough to make us conclude that this is not going to suppress the whole thing.
I see.
Okay. So this would definitely be finite as far as we can see.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah.